When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
This is iFanboy Media Splode, episode 41, Killers of the Flower Moon. And does any movie need to be 3 hours long?
Oh, I'll twine with flamingos and waving black hair, where the rose is so red and the lily so fair, and the myrtle's bright with the emerald dew, the pale and the leader and eyes look like blue.
Hello, welcome to iFanboy Media Split, episode 41. My name is Connor Kilpatrick. I'm here with Josh Flanagan.
Hey there.
And Ron Richards.
We are on our last legs, everyone.
Ron and I are both in rough shape.
Both in rough shape.
Josh to hold it together.
I already went through it. I'm good now.
So we apologize for any sniffling, sneezing, coughing, or stuffy head feelings.
Whoa. We're not doing ads.
But we're here. We showed up. That's the thing. When people ask me about podcasting and they say, what was what made the difference for you and the iFanboy guys? I just say, we showed up.
We showed up every week. We were there.
Yep. Whether you wanted us or not, here we are.
Like on your mail.
Phone. Yep. Like Lumberg.
This show was unlocked by the patrons at patreon.com/iFanboy. Thanks to all the patrons, and you should consider being one today. You can do it for as little as the $1 a month. We appreciate everyone who supports the show.
Could you have done that any faster?
It's got a lot of practice.
And I don't know, spoilers or whatever. I don't even know what's going on.
We're
going
to talk about shit. We're going to talk about stuff that happened. Yeah. So if you don't want to know about it, you press pause. In fact, at one point in the podcast, Josh will leave.
That's true.
It's my line in the sand.
It's long past time.
To avoid spoiler.
Honestly, if I had known that was an option,
so
I wouldn't have shown up.
I also apologize to anyone who's never listened to the show before and stumbled on this for the first time. Usually it's much more buttoned up, but we are in sick, weird moods, so this is the show you got.
And hey, it's going to be fun. You know, this is when anything can happen, really.
We're going to open this show, and I just noticed my phone's cracked, with the segment we always start with, which is what we've been enjoying since we last discussed media. And I'll start real quick with, in the last 3 or 4 weeks since we did the show, one of those weeks I was out of the country, didn't watch anything during that time. So the week before that trip and ever since I've been back is mostly consumed with the baseball playoffs. Ron, you're probably watching a little less than I am because
some of
the teams you hate, but
hate them with a passion.
It's been a really fun baseball playoffs. Right as we record this right now, it's the seventh game of the NLCS. No, the ALCS. I'm sorry. I still think of the Astros as being in the NL.
No, me too.
I find myself mostly watching to root against teams. Like, I don't have any feelings about the Rangers either way, but I'm rooting against the Astros, and I was rooting against the Braves, things like that.
See, the thing is, I can't hate watch sports. I want
to
get
into it. I'm watching a good game, but I'm hoping I'm less hoping the Rangers win, more hoping the Astros lose. You know what I'm saying?
No, I understand. Yeah, but I hate watch is a hyperbole term, but like, you know, like I don't want to root for someone to lose. You know,
is there baseball that you're like not? Like, you don't really have an affinity for one of the teams, but there's good players and it's fun to watch.
Yeah, I want to watch a good game. Absolutely.
Yeah, you can appreciate the players. The challenge, at least for me, is once the Mets are out, right, then usually de facto I am then rooting for whoever in the National League is playing because I'm a National League guy, right?
Really?
Those American League fucks, they know what they did. That stupid DH, like a plague.
Yeah.
But the problem is that this year, the majority of the teams that made it to the playoffs were all teams I hate because they're rivals of the Mets, or I'm just indifferent and I can't bring myself to root for the Diamondbacks.
Can you not root for the Diamondbacks because they're an expansion league team from 30 years ago and
they just make no impact whatsoever?
That's fair.
If they play against the Astros, I'll root for them, but they just don't make a difference.
like in basketball, I still have like a little bit of like, that's an expansion team. It was in the early 90s, but like I don't quite take the Magic seriously.
A little dismissive. That might be a part of it. I mean, for me, and I'm going to apologize to any Diamondbacks fans that are listening.
Yeah.
To me, the Diamondbacks are like, oh man, I'm trying to think of like a really bland food. You know, that there's no real excitement in eating it, or, you know, like it's graham crackers. Cool.
And the thing is, like, every sports fan is a lunatic at some level. And so.
And here's my lunacy.
And so, as Ron says, he roots against any team that's rival the Mets. I'll root against any team that has ever hurt me emotionally against the Yankees. So, like, I can't root for the Diamondbacks really 100% because of 2001.
Sure. That makes sense. Yeah.
The Astros, obviously. So, like, you know, it comes down to Ron hates the Phillies. I might be rooting for the Phillies just because that's the last chance I got. There's no one else left to root for. So
I'm not going to root for Bryce Harper. He knows
the LCSs, the American National League Championship Series, have been terrific. They're both going to 7 games. Love the 7th game. And cool. So if you're a baseball fan, this has been a really high enjoyment playoff series. Sometimes they just, you know, they just roll through and teams get swept. But that happened a lot in the first round of the playoffs. But the second round has been terrific. There's been three rounds. Is it 3 rounds now?
Too many rounds. That's all it is.
Those the wild card. Yes, yeah, so there's 3 rounds. The wild card round, the division series round. So the first 2 rounds were okay. The third round's been terrific.
Yep.
This isn't even the part that I'm not supposed to be here for, and I'm feeling like...
Ron, you went out into the world.
I did go out into the world. A couple of months ago, when I saw the news that the state was doing a live show, a reunion of sorts, that was an easily purchasable ticket.
By the way, he means the comedy group, not like the Russian government.
Right, correct, yeah.
The state is doing a show, we must go.
Yeah, well, obviously, we must go. Let's do that. Yeah.
No, it is the comedy troupe from the early 90s MTV that featured the likes of David Wayne and Michael Ian Black and Michael Showalter and
Thomas Lennon,
Ken Marino, the ageless Ken Marino, who, by the way, looks better than we should all hope to look as good as Ken Marino looks when we
because get he's been dipping his balls in it all along.
Exactly. So I got to admit, I've seen like after the state broke up, I saw Showalter and Black and Wayne do Stella. Obviously, we all watched the movie Wet Hot American Summer and it, you know, their universe kind of expanded and they've gone on to do, you know, great things. You know, Michael Showalter now is an acclaimed director and, you know, Michael Ian Black of the fame and fortune that comes with Mike and Tommy Snacks. Wonderful podcast. But so when they saw they were doing this, I'm like, oh, this is a no-brainer. But I didn't quite know what to expect because it's like, are they just going to show sketches and talk about it? Or are they going to just like do, you know? And so when they did the live show, it was a full production. And they did a sketch and it was very funny. And then they all came out and introduced themselves and talked. And Michael Ian Black was like, yeah, you know, we're going to do some old stuff. We're going to do some new stuff. We're going to do some old stuff with some new stuff. And I got to give them credit. They tapped into the archive of what this worked for the state in 1993 on MTV and updated it for an audience that is now middle-aged in a very smart and funny way.
That's cool.
And they are just so funny. They're just like honestly, I don't think I've laughed as hard as I laughed during the show for a long time.
That group defined a comedic sensibility for a long time.
Yes. Yep.
Not the dominant one in America, but one of those like super nerdy subsets of comedy. They defined that for a long time.
The kids in the hall of that era.
Yep.
You know, that sort of.
And all those guys went on to, as Ron said, had great careers.
And they're so funny. They're just so funny.
And for years, Ron would just constantly make state references. You stopped at some point, but for years it was just like
I know. We still do.
That's a limited audience.
Exactly. They did. I do it at work, and people look at me like I'm crazy. I was on a podcast the other day. I was doing a tech podcast, and we were like prepping for the show, and there was like the leave button for the studio. You know, like kind of like you need to click that to make sure your file uploaded or whatever. Mm-hmm. And like, do you see the big red button at the bottom? I'm like, oh, the big red button that says Bobo, and. Nobody laughed. And I was like, yeah, it's a state reference.
I don't know it that well. Like, I know a bunch of them, but I never know the ones
it was
you know.
When the mime was pretending to fly a plane, but he couldn't land it. So they had to bring in a pilot to talk him down. It's Thomas Lennon as the pilot. And he's trying to like, the plane full of mimes. It's like, it's so good. They also interspersed in between the sketches when they did like the stage reset and costume changes. They played old clips of the state doing PSAs at MTV Spring Break at Panama at Daytona Beach and stuff like that. So that was very funny. They played some sketches from the CBS pilot, the failed pilot that only aired once. That's not available anywhere. So they had like they definitely tapped into like, hey, you've loved us for a long time. Here's some history stuff. But like a great example is they. I don't know if you guys remember. Do you remember Mike Lee and Black and Thomas Lennon doing the Barry and Levon $246 worth of pudding sketch?
Kind of. Like vaguely.
They were like two Barry White kind of, you know, like, oh yeah, we're so sexy and we got $246 worth of pudding. Right. And it was just, you know, that sort of thing. And so they came out and started playing the music. And like the people behind me were the kind of people who like say the punchline a minute before.
Oh.
Oh, so annoying. And
say it with it.
Right. No, yeah. But before, right?
Maybe.
And so they come out and she's like, $246 worth of pudding. And they start laughing and they come out and they do their thing like, oh yeah, we're here to bring you $246 of reversible mortgages. And they twisted the whole sketch to be about reversible mortgages, which me at 16, not funny. Right. Me at 46, very funny.
Sadly yeah. funny.
Right. So kudos to the state. They did shows in Denver. They did shows in New York. I believe they're still touring. I think they're doing West Coast next. So I know a friend of the show, Chris Albrecht, reached out to me. So he saw me post about it and he's like, oh, I saw you post. And then I saw they're playing Seattle and I grabbed a ticket. So like you can, if you like the state, do not miss the show. If you like comedy, don't miss the show. It's a lot of fun. Hopefully this is the beginning of more from them.
If you were any kind of, I don't need to say niche fandom, but if you had any kind of fandom in the '90s or, you know, you can come back around now and have a successful, you know, it's a nice little a
nostalgia place. Right. So
a little bit of money for them, which is nice.
Yeah, I'm all for that. I'm all
like
for
when
it.
We were younger, I remember there would be like nostalgics and like the 50s music cavalcades, the you know, guys, go yeah. around it. And yeah. it was kind of sad in a way to us, maybe. But now, no, I mean, like as a kid, I mean, and then that was also the joke.
Wasn't to me, Alex, I knew one of those guys, so it wasn't, I didn't
right. No, but I'm saying like the joke was always like, oh, there's the Rolling Stones trotting them out again. And now my perspective on it has shifted greatly. I mean, I know specifically like Ron and I, like a lot of bands who, you know, that was their time. And now they're middle-aged and they're out and they're playing music for the people because, you know.
Good. But we want to see it. Awesome. Let them get some money. I'm all
and they
for
can,
it. It's,
and then they can make a career. They can play their music. They can, you know.
It is literally the reverse of our attitude in our teens and early 20s about fucking sellouts. You know, like it is, you know, like.
That's because those teens didn't have bills to pay.
Exactly. And mouths to feed.
That's there was no such thing as selling out. Like that was just. Doesn't count.
Yeah. Anyway, so go check out the state. Strongly recommended.
I want to catch up on two shows that I have both finished and almost finished. One, I was very surprised to learn, and I don't know when this happened, but there's a third season of Wu-Tang and American Saga.
I had no idea.
I thought, goodness, what else could happen? And this is about the solo album era and leading into the second album. And the thing about this season is several of the episodes are like reenactment plays of the theme of the album. And so the Liquid Swords episode is like Jizza in a post-apocalyptic world where he's got to bring the music to save the people. And then the Old Dirty Bastard album is like an old timey crime syndicate who runs clubs.
It's a genre swerve.
I don't like those episodes very much. And it's like, I want to finish this because I've been along so long, but they were like eventually, like by the end, you're like, all right. And then it's over and you go, thank God. And I thought it was just going to be the one for the Old Dirty. I was like, oh, they're doing a little experiment here. That's kind of fun. No, they did several. And like, there's a whole crime thing for Raekwon's album and Cuban Lynx. And, you know, ugh, I think they're running out of things to talk about. I think Method Man's barely in this season at all.
Are you thinking they should have left it with two seasons?
I mean, if people are watching it and they're doing the thing, it's fine. And I like that they get to experiment, but I just don't think it works as well. It was never like a great show.
Do you want them to get as far as to address the Martin Shkreli Wu-Tang album thing?
I don't think I would mind a couple of special episodes along, but not really. No, I don't think that's necessary. I think Wu-Tang Forever comes out. We can pretty much that's kind of the end of the you know, the dramatic arc part of the story.
Do you know what happened to that album, by the way?
I don't remember. The government didn't like
the government sold it. And they said the album, the proceeds were enough to satisfy what remained of the $7.4 million forfeiture judgment against Shkreli was. Yeah.
So when he bought it for $1 million, he made a great investment.
Peter Schoolidge, a New York lawyer who says he represented the unknown buyer in a statement, said, "This is the most interesting deal I've ever worked on." So someone unknown has the record.
Someone with just an enormous amount of money or a terrible sense of financial responsibility.
Right. Well, those people. Both. Yeah, or both. And it's just a matter of time before he ends up in prison with Shkreli.
It's unfair. Second, I wanted to talk about, Connor had mentioned this on, I want to say this show, but it may have been the year end.
Yeah, this show. Maybe both.
I went back and I watched all of 1883, which is the prequel to, is it Yellowstone?
Yes.
Okay. I actually watched a few episodes of Yellowstone and I just kind of.
Well, it's the prequel in that universe. There's another series, 1923, that takes place between them.
Right. So it's a prequel.
Yeah.
And like, I think it was interesting because it is a full on romantic Western, like no holds barred. It's beautiful. There's not a lot of ground being broken, I guess. You know, like Sam Elliott shows up and I was like, yeah, okay, that had to happen. So it was almost like half modern and half throwbacky, I think, in a way. But I kind of liked the like really sticking to the genre. And leaning into it hard. I think it was absolutely beautiful. You know, there's sort of basically a bunch of vaguely European, possibly German immigrants need to cross from Texas to Oregon where there is free land. And they hitch up with Sam Elliott, who they hire to protect them, and a bunch of other hands, cowpokes. I don't know what they are. Cowboys. Some of them call themselves cowboys. Yeah. And then Tim McGraw and his wife, Faith Hill, who play other people. Duttons. They're Duttons, right?
So they're the ancestors of Kevin Costner. Right. Yeah.
And then their daughter. And I would say that everything that happens with a daughter is pretty unexpected and against type. If there's a deconstruction to it, it's that, where everything else around that is very rigid to the genre. And I'm not going to say it was great, but I do think I really enjoyed it. And I really enjoyed the commitment to doing the thing. Like, I was like, this looks expensive. I mean, Taylor Sheridan has got a lot of power now. And I feel like he used it to make this thing. And I don't know who wanted to see it, but I'm glad it existed. Yeah, no, he gets to.
All these shows are very popular.
Yeah, I'm sure.
I do find the business side of these shows just fascinating. Of the fact that like all the machinations and like what's on Peacock versus or what's on Paramount Plus and what they started putting the original Yellowstone on CBS, but it required all these edits to be made and all this. Like I haven't watched a minute of this show and I'm fascinated by it all.
It does reinforce that you never ever wanted to be on the Oregon Trail.
Oh absolutely. Yeah. I also think I can't remember her name, but the female lead of it was very good.
Yes.
And very young. And I say this without being lecherous, like extremely attractive. You're like, that is a beautiful person. In such that I was like, you're not going to stay this beautiful out on the trail like this. It's not possible. But again, it's like I said, it's a romantic kind of thing. And she like narrates the whole thing in this sort of like deep voice that belies her age entirely. And a lot of the stuff that happened with her was unexpected.
Yeah.
Also, I thought that the parents were fantastic.
I was surprised. I mean, I've seen Tim McGraw in a lot of stuff before, but...
Not great, but he was
real, real, really good. And yeah. So was Faith Hill.
Yep. I agree.
And so you need to watch the next one now, which stars Harrison Ford and Helen Mirren.
Where do you put that on the, like, how is it better? Is it worse? Is it fine?
It's just different. It's not better. I think 1883 is more compelling, but I really did enjoy it. Like, Timothy Dalton's also in it. It's got a lot of people.
James Bond?
Yeah.
The guy who owns the supermarket in the movie that came after Shaun of the Dead?
Yes. What was that? Hot Fuzz.
Yeah, I was getting there.
It's that weird time, which is actually a very similar time to what we're going to talk about, Killers of the Flower Moon, where it's still kind of the Old West out in the middle of the country, but it's 1920, so there's cars and machine guns and things. So it's interesting, and Harrison Ford is terrific in it, so I think you'll enjoy it.
Cool.
All right, so...
I'm going to go now.
That's what we've been enjoying. We're going to say goodbye to Josh temporarily.
Have we figured out our mechanism to get him back?
We haven't.
Are you going to text me? You're putting it in Slack.
You tell us, Josh, because your responsiveness is questionable.
Should we text you?
Yeah, I'm sitting right here. I'm not going anywhere.
Okay.
Oh, we'll text you.
Text you or Slack you? What do you want to do?
I mean, if you want to be safe, both aren't a bad idea. No, you can text me. I'll be fine.
All right. Text you. Okay.
We'll say goodbye to Josh. Bye, Josh.
Goodbye, Josh.
Okay, so Josh is gone. Ron and I are going to talk about Killers of the Flower Moon, the new Robert. Who's Robert? The new Martin Scorsese film.
Well, star Robert De Niro's in it. That's fine.
I think the meds are kicking in.
So to give everyone context, we were the movie literally just opened this past weekend. Connor and I both saw it. Josh did not, so that's why he's stepping away, because he does not want it to be spoiled. Yep. So, which is a lesson for you, listener. If you don't want to be spoiled, stop and check the show notes. Come back in 20 minutes when we're done talking about it, and that'll be fine. Part of the reason why Josh did not see it, and part of the reason why I almost didn't see it, is that it is very hard to go see a 3.5 hour long movie.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's just 3.5 hours is the actual runtime. But then you have to tack on.
Oh, the half hour of Nicole Kidman and the stupid trailers.
Oh, you at AMC. Oh. Yeah, I didn't have that. But it's still going to the theater and then coming home from the theater.
Yeah. All right. So Killers of the Flower Moon. We've been waiting for it. Scorsese's first movie for Apple, right? Apple TV Plus.
Yeah, he's just bouncing around to whichever streaming service
will pay him.
$300 million dollars to make a movie.
Surprise, surprise, Leonardo DiCaprio. Surprise, surprise, Robert De Niro. Surprise, surprise, 3 hours longer than 3 hours. Like, Marty just, he's got a checklist at this point now in his 80s.
Right. And it is interesting. I mean, there's a lot to discuss here. This is based on a book that I read by David Grann, Killers of the Flower Moon. I actually read the book a couple of years ago, and then I listened to the audiobook on a road trip earlier this year. So I've actually pretty well-versed in the story. Based on a real event, which was called the Osage Reign of Terror, where members of the Osage Indian tribe in Oklahoma started dying mysteriously, or not mysteriously, but in big numbers in the 1920s because their reservation land was on top of vast oil fields, and they had the mineral rights to those oil fields, and they became the richest people per capita in the world.
This is something that I had no idea happened. Similar to the Tulsa massacre, the race riots in Tulsa that we saw, when the Watchmen show on HBO tapped into that. Also eerie that it's the same state, right? Same time period, absolutely, all this unrest. But I literally had no idea that they moved, the Trail of Tears, Indians get moved to reservations. The Osage Indians end up on this reservation. They strike oil. The government decides that they are not capable of managing their own money. And so they assign guardians to watch over the money for everybody. The adjusted for inflation numbers for this is insane. They were making like something like $30 million a year off the oil rights, which in today's money is something like $700 million, right? Yeah. And Indians were walking away, or the Osage Indians were walking away with like a monthly payment of like $19,000, which in our money now is like hundreds of thousands of dollars, right? And so you had this real flip where, like, the Osage Indians had nice clothes, they had cars, they had white servants, like fascinating, and had no idea this happened. And all the interesting thing, like you said, is the most wealthiest people per square mile, right? The focus of wealthy people. But they also, there were 8 lawyers in this town, right, to cover 40,000 people or something like that, which corresponds to another city in Oklahoma that had like 3 lawyers for 150,000 people, right? It just showed that how the, well-to-do establishment white people kind of, zoomed in and saw opportunity here, which then leads to this horrific massacre that happened.
So that's, and getting into that stuff is going to be a discussion point later, but because it happened at the same time as the Tulsa massacre, they actually referenced it several times in the movie, which I found myself kind of sad leaving it, that after the Watchmen show, that first episode, the next day everyone was talking about the fact that most people didn't know about the Tulsa, like it was the news. It was like, I remember watching a story about it in the evening news. Like, this I think won't have the same impact, because that was, the Watchmen was pre streaming, and the people still kind of all watch the same thing at the same time. And
I don't have my heart to get into this conversation.
So I'm just saying it's not making the same impact, because it's just the monoculture was still kind of around back then.
And it's also a challenge. Again, it's a 3.5 hour movie. It requires a commitment. It is a heavy drama.
Yeah.
And like, we're looking at the box office numbers, it didn't unseat Taylor Swift, which I didn't think it would, but like, it's even not like the hopes that Oppenheimer was over 3 hours. We're going to talk about 3 hour movies in a little bit later on the show.
That was Barbenheimer.
But Oppenheimer isn't a good comp because of, it was the summer and Barbie and Barbenheimer and all that sort of stuff. But whatever, let's talk about the movie itself though.
What's interesting to me is how Scorsese has changed as a filmmaker as he's gotten older.
Sure.
I mean, he's I don't know, all of our favorite filmmaker, maybe Tarantino's might be mine, but Scorsese would be a number two in terms of active filmmakers still working, making films. But, the guy who made, I think you might have heard him talk about this. You can tell me, the guy who made like the, Goodfellas, that moved like a freight train.
Yep.
He doesn't make those movies anymore.
Well, I saw him speak at the Museum of the Moving Image in here in New York City. We saw a screening of Silence, which another 3 hour plus Marty movie, and him and Thelma Shoemaker his editor was on, and she's not young either.
She's like 83, I think.
Yeah. And Marty was talking about, he's like, movies these days, it's pow, 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 cut, 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 cut. And then he paused and he nudges Thelma and goes, I guess we're responsible for that, huh? because he kind of, with Goodfellas and all those other movies, kind of like laid that as a groundwork, but he has evolved. And I find it fascinating reading, like the profiles of him coming up to this movie where he's like, I'm discovering what filmmaker I am now, still in my 80s. Like he's still discovering himself, which, is a fascinating journey. And it's fun to watch for us.
The pace of this film is very similar to The Irishman.
Yes.
In that it's a lot of slow, and I'm not saying this derogatory, but it's slow, it's languid. There's one point where Leonardo DiCaprio is talking to Lily Gladstone, who plays his wife, Molly, and Leo plays Ernest.
Who's fantastic, by the way. She was great.
It's like a 5 minute conversation, which in movie time feels like eternity. Oh. And I was like, wow, they're still going.
What also got me was there were several points in time where, so Leonardo DiCaprio plays Robert De Niro's nephew, right? Robert De Niro plays a cattle rancher who has befriended the Osage Indians and is a supporter of their community, but he's also strategically placing people to marry their women to get the rights, their oil rights, right, quietly. And then as the movie goes, he kind of amps up the getting rid of people so he can get, so greed can win out.
He becomes Jimmy in Goodfellas after the heist.
Yeah, he does. I saw a lot of parallels of Goodfellas here, by the way. And maybe that's because I'm biased. But Leonardo DiCaprio plays this kind of unwitting, dumb nephew from Texas who comes back from World War I looking for a job. And he strategically uses him. And he lines him up with this woman that De Niro knows, the family. And he hits it off with the daughter of the family, this woman who, and they eventually get married and have this life together and all this stuff happens. What you got is white man marrying Osage Indian. There's one point in the late part of the film where they have a long extended conversation
in Osage,
with no subtitles.
Yeah.
And they had subtitles earlier in the film.
They stopped at some point. They stopped at some point.
And what I found fascinating was that I knew exactly what they were talking about. I knew exactly, like, the acting was getting the emotions across. And it was like watching a foreign film. It's another language that I don't know or understand.
You had to read their facial expressions and their body language. And you totally could follow. It was interesting, your choice to make, though. But it was interesting to see, like, this was a very different kind of experience. And also, the way he has changed, the way he shoots action or violence is different. So if you think back to Goodfellas, I think about Goodfellas a lot because we did a whole podcast about it. But, when Tommy is, killing Billy Bats, it's like all up in your face and you're right up in it. Like it's disturbing. It's like you're almost in that moment. Whereas here and in The Irishman, he shoots all his action at these wide, dispassionate angles.
Yep.
Where it's almost like the violence is mundane. And by that makes it more horrific because it's like casual.
That combined with the volume, right? Because and this gets back to the length issue, because like I really struggled with, did this movie need to be 3 hours? And like, and the fact that Marty's got this track record of all these like very long movies, and at some point you got to kill your babies, and like it's better to edit and make it tighter and shorter. But in this particular, and like at one point in the movie when another person in this woman's family dies, right, and they use the similar shot of dead people laying in state on a bed, right, like there was a visual language that was established throughout the film. And at one point when somebody died, I was like, oh my God, another one? Jesus Christ. And in my head, I'm like, they could have cut out half of those deaths and moved the story along, but the volume of deaths that we experienced through this family's eyes drove the horrificness of what had happened. I came around on it where I'm like, no, that needs to be in there because you need to pile on and feel the pain and feel the horror and the lack of response by the local government or anything like that. And the helplessness that they may have felt against some, mysterious force that is destroying their family. Like I thought I totally came around on it. I'm like, it's totally justified and makes perfect sense. And I felt the length, but I never looked at my watch.
Oh, I didn't either. I thought this was a 3.5 hour movie that didn't feel at all like 3.5 hours.
Yeah.
I really liked it overall. I want to say that because I do have some criticisms, but I did really think it was a really well done film. So if you go back to the beginning, this was originally developed by Scorsese and DiCaprio as a streaming series.
Interesting.
originally DiCaprio was going to play part that Jesse Plemons played, the FBI agent who comes to investigate the crime. And originally it was going to be much more of a whodunit mystery, and they decided to completely change it and make it a film. And I'm not someone who ever says things like, oh, this should have been a series, because I feel like it's the sort of de rigueur thought, because everyone's obsessed with streaming series. And I think the movie has value. I think sitting down for watching a story in an hour and a half to 3 hour time frame is valuable. I don't think everything needs to be a series, but this one kind of needed to be a series. I'll tell you, as someone who's read the book and listened to the book, they didn't put in half of it. I mean, what you saw, and you said there was so much more horror that happened.
Yep.
You know, that in the movie, the white man goes to Washington to try to get help from the government. He gets murdered on the streets of Washington. That was the second one that happened to. They sent two guys to Washington. They both got murdered. They cut stuff like that, that really, when you're reading the book, made it feel like there was a demon in this town, because people just kept dying every few pages of suicide, I'm putting in quotes, or poisoned whiskey or poisoned medicine. It was oppressive in the film, but it was really oppressive in the book. Like, you really got the sense that this is like this out of control situation that no one can stop. The other thing I thought they didn't do a great job of in the movie was, you mentioned it earlier, but I thought they didn't do a great job of explaining the economic situation fully, of the fact that even though these tribe members are really rich, they didn't have full control over their money.
Yeah, that was it was subtle, and you spent the better, well, and it's interesting because, like, I think I'm okay with that, because you spent the better first third of the movie trying to figure out what's going on.
Right.
And it was challenging, right? To try to understand why she wanted to do something. She had to go talk to somebody, and he's like, well, I don't know if that's a good use of your money, and that sort of thing. It's like, and admittedly, all the reading I did coming out of the film educated me and made me better understand it, which I enjoy that process, right? So I wrestle with that.
As Ron said, like, once this oil was discovered, and suddenly this tribe was super rich, then the white establishment in the country came, you know, swooped in like vultures to try to take the money through the system of governance, where they had no control. So they would appoint these guardians for each Indian family had a guardian. They had to run their money decisions through, and they were able to siphon money out
until they were able to prove that they could manage their own money,
the businesses would overcharge. There was one point in the movie where DiCaprio's mad at the funeral guy because he's charging him Osage prices, because they quadrupled the price for everything. Like, it was like everything they could do to steal, they did, which leads to my major point of criticism of the movie, which is not a huge thing, but it kind of gave you the impression that this entire thing was Bill Hale's doing. Bill Hale is De Niro's character. He's sort of the crime boss of Osage County, and it gave you the impression that he was the mastermind of everything. And once he was arrested and went to prison, it stopped,
but it didn't.
It didn't. Right. It was actually a conspiracy involving literally hundreds of white people to get this, to have this happen. So he was a main cog of it, but it was every powerful person. They showed the sheriff, and they showed the two doctors were involved, but like, it was so much bigger than just this one guy and his one family.
Right.
But the movie kind of gave you the impression it was just his doing.
Well, because and it's wasn't, a movie,
it was,
right?
Which gives it even a more of a horror, because it's everybody in the county was involved, except for maybe a handful of white people who weren't involved, one of whom got blown up in the movie. The rest of them were all involved in this murder conspiracy.
Right. Well, but the thing is, I forgive that, because it's a movie and they got to make decisions and you got to give a narrative, and like, and that makes sense. But overall, I thought it was extremely engaging, extremely immersive. You really felt like you were there. There's some beautiful shots.
Oh, absolutely.
The discovery of the oil shot.
Oh.
The fire at Hale's Ranch. I think about that
fire shot through the door.
That fire shot was so good, right? There were some really great cinema moments.
The tracking shot through the house after DiCaprio marries Lily Gladstone, and it goes from a house with just her and her mom to his family moves in.
Yep.
The camera tracks through the whole house in this continuous shot, swooping around, and you're seeing how there's like 25 people now living in this house, none of whom are from the original family. It was really well done and really evocative.
Yeah. Now, I will say, and I did see, you know, it's hard not to see parallels to Goodfellas, right? Sure. You know, like some of the shots, stuff like that, but like the courtroom scene, you know, when DiCaprio's sitting and he fingers Robert De Niro, I mean, it was a very tone poem, you know, to Goodfellas. And I will say, Marty shows up with a challenging way to end the movie in the same way that he did with Goodfellas, where Goodfellas, you know, he chooses to break the fourth wall. have Ray Liotta, Henry Hill step up out of the shot and talk directly to the camera. Whereas in this film, it reaches its, you know, kind of end point, and we cut to the future. Spoiler, I'm sorry, but we cut to the future. Unknown time, must be 40s or 50s.
I read something that said it was the 30s, but I don't know. Because that's when that show aired. The show they were doing.
But it's a true crime radio show that is telling the story that we see and kind of saying what happened to everybody. And then finally they get to Leonardo's wife, Molly, who's played by Lily Gladstone. And it's Marty on stage who reads what happens to her.
I thought it was incredibly powerful to have him do it. Totally. And I think... Yeah, you know, it can be taken lots of ways. My interpretation at the time, and I haven't changed it yet, is that it was sort of a commentary on how, you know, all this real life tragedy just ends up becoming entertainment.
Right.
You know, our obsession with true crime at the moment as a culture.
Yep.
And the fact that, you know, he says in the thing, like, you know, in her obituary, didn't even mention the murders. Like, it was sort of like everything is sort of lost into history until it becomes entertainment again. But to go back to the courtroom shot, there's the one part where the camera just stays on Leo.
Yep.
For his entire interrogation, and I thought that was an incredible bit of acting. Well,
let's talk about Leo. What did you think of his performance?
I thought everyone in the movie was great.
Yeah, he had a real
except for Brendan Fraser.
I saw an article: should Brendan Fraser give his Oscar back after this movie? Which I was like, come on.
He wasn't terrible, but he was a little over the top.
Yeah, he was a little over the top, but it's fine. Leo had a real Billy Bob Thornton Sling Blade grimace going on. Well,
he had
an
implant in his mouth to make his give him an overbite. But I thought he was doing some real acting. Like he was. He wasn't doing glamorous. You know, he wasn't handsome. He was handsome, but he was. You know, they made him look a little bit. You know,
and I'm fascinated by how much of a idiot he was. Like, if you go back, if you follow the crime, if you follow all the crimes, a lot of the problems were his character in real life, really, you know, making stupid decisions and stupid choices that led to them getting caught or all these kind of stuff. And then also how he was kind of, you know, not a patsy, but like thrown to the wolves by his uncle, by De Niro's character in like, you know. He, you know, De Niro's character wouldn't talk to somebody about killing somebody. He had to send his nephew, Leo's character, to do it, right?
He was totally manipulating him to take the fall in case it ever had to happen.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And the point where he says, hey, I need you to sign this paperwork in case anything happens to you.
Yeah, it's okay. It's all right, yeah.
The whole audience sort of giggled, you know, even though it's horrible, but like, because it's...
De Niro was fantastic.
He was great.
Elder statesman De Niro. Like, it was like, it's a different kind of role, older gentleman, you know, like all that sort of stuff. I thought he was fantastic. He still carried, you know, like it felt a lot like Jimmy and Goodfellas, you know, like especially the paper signing where it's like, you know, like, no, it's okay. Go down.
He's interesting. Physically, I saw him in another movie over the weekend and he's gone past sort of middle age paunch, you know, that we all sort of hit. And now he's that like elderly wiry. Like he's lost a lot of weight. Yep. He's got this interesting sort of, he almost looks kind of like Pesci in The Irishman. Like they're both super skinny and wiry now.
Right.
And so his physicality is really interesting. He is about 25 years older than William Hill was at the time.
Yeah.
I think William Hill was like 45 when the events happened and DiCaprio's character was 24.
Jeez. Well, everyone died earlier.
It's not a big deal. Actors are actors, but it is slightly different because one of Molly's sisters, I think it was Anna, was pregnant, and there's a lot of speculation that it was his baby. Like,
oh yeah,
so like he was much more of a vital younger man.
Yeah, no, he fully infiltrated the whole community. It was So all right, well, so overall, it sounds like you're a thumbs up.
Yeah, it was really enjoyable. I mean, I really enjoyed The Irishman. I enjoyed this probably a little bit more, only because I don't think I was prepared for what The Irishman was as opposed to what my expectation was for it.
Well, the problem was that with The Irishman was it was
not Goodfellas.
A known quantity. What I really found interesting about this movie is that this specific movie defies genre, or at least defies
sticking
to a genre.
It's a lot of genres, yeah.
It's a lot of genres mixed. So you got the crime element, you've got the cowboy element, you've got the historical, you know, historical fiction or historical fact.
It's a family
element.
Movie and it's a love story and it's weird.
Right, it's a drama. It's a, yeah, like it hits on so many notes and it becomes almost like the movie is less of a song than rather a symphony of a collection of songs.
Yeah. Absolutely.
You know, like that's why, like, I think, you know, seeing in the press and stuff like that, people referring to it as a masterpiece and epic, like those are all well deserved. Like this is probably the best recent Marty movie.
Oh, yeah.
Since The Departed.
He's still got it.
Oh, for sure.
And, you know, he's 80. I think he's turning 81 next month. And, you know, hopefully he's with us another 10 years and makes another 5 movies. He's still one of the most interesting people making films today. We didn't even get to talk about the fact that this movie's got like 15 musicians in it.
Yeah.
Playing parts.
Right.
I did not look at my watch one time. I didn't feel the length one time. If you told me this was a 2-hour movie, I would have believed you because it just sort of flew by. Even though it was a very languidly paced, I don't know. It's the magic of Martin Scorsese, I guess.
Right. He's great. I mean, yeah, I saw a 9:45 film. I think I got home by 2. I was a wreck the next day. But similar, like, it made me think. And I went back and did the research, and I was reading about what had really happened and drawing those parallels. And, like,
people do that, because it is – I mean, yeah. It is as bad as Tulsa. Both Tulsa and Osage County should be different places today. They should be wealthy. Yep. The oil money would have run out eventually, but they should have been able to invest in their community, invest in other businesses, invest in
themselves. Oh, it's horrifying what happened.
Thriving community within Oklahoma, and Tulsa should have had an entirely different history for their Black community. And both of those are horrible in the same way. And if this movie does anything, hopefully like people like you will read more about it.
For sure. Yeah. Yeah.
And also, it was shot on location. Everyone involved who was a Native character was played by a Native person. The Osage elders were all involved in the movie in terms of guiding it. And it was beautiful. I thought the last shot, too, of the modern-day Osage doing the ceremony was really emotional. Like, I think it was really just a really good movie.
Yeah, it was great. So, yeah, thumbs up. Totally great. I would encourage people to go see it. You know, don't be scared by the three-hour, movie length.
3.5 hours.
3.5 hours. Yeah. Which, and we're going to talk about that when Josh comes back, but like 3 hours is one thing. 3.5 hours is a bridge that you really, and like, honestly, I'm shocked that it made $25 million this past weekend that it did, So I'm glad to see, people still coming out to it.
Well, yeah. If you saw it at AMC, then you've got to add on another 30 minutes of trailers. Sure. That's 4 hours. Then the time to get to the film and get home. I saw it during the day for that very reason, but I could do that because I don't have kids, but I saw the 3 o'clock show. I got home at like 8 o'clock.
Yeah,
because I went out for food afterwards, but still.
All right, so Killers of the Flower Moon, we both give it thumbs up.
Yep.
Go check it out, see what you think. We will look forward to hearing what Josh thinks when he finds 3.5 hours to go to the movies to watch it.
Well, that's not counting travel time.
And so let's talk about the 3.5 hour movie length. No one's done the study on it. We don't have the numbers, but it does feel like there are more 3 hour plus movies now and post pandemic than there were at least pre pandemic, and that may be wrong, but it feels that way.
Wasn't it the 2010s? There was only like 2 or 3 movies that went over 3 hours. Like there was like a very small number between 2010 and 2020.
And even you can expand it out to 2.5 hours. Like there's definitely an epidemic of long films at the moment.
Yeah. So here it is. The 2010s only had 2 Hollywood movies go over 3 hours in length. And so in comparison, the 1990s had 15.
It used to mean like it used to have something to do with with a prestige thing. So Lawrence of Arabia, Bridge over on the River Kwai, that kind of thing. I don't know. I know Lawrence of Arabia is. Yeah, exactly.
Stemming from this conversation was I came home from the film the next day, and my wife was like, "So how was it?" And I told her how Killers of the Flower Moon was and all this stuff. And then I was like, "But it was long." And she's like, "Did it need to be 3.5 hours?" It's like, does any movie need to be over 3 hours, right? And it's kind of in reaction to that where, to the trend that we have of these longer films and the question of, like, are we indulging the filmmakers to a point where the length is getting out of control, and do movies that are north of 3 hours really need to be 3 hours long or more? And I thought that was an interesting question. Like, I'm not saying I agree with her or anyone who's against it or whatnot, but it is fascinating to see films like this, and then when you start digging into the other movies that are 3 hours plus long, like that choice.
I'm gonna be the asshole that says it depends, and every movie's its own. But I've certainly seen a 3 hour movie and I've gone, that didn't need to be a 3 hour movie.
Right.
I'm thinking of Babylon, a movie I enjoyed. Yep. I was one of the 5 people on earth who enjoyed it, but you could have easily have cut a half hour, maybe even an hour out of that movie.
My review of Babylon was that it was two movies. There's like 3 movies packed in there.
Cut one of them out. All the one that Tobey Maguire was in.
So what's interesting to me, though, is that, historically there has been an economic reason for not doing extra long movies. Exhibitors want to get more people in for more shows.
There. They just ignore it.
Sure, I know. But also, like, how people go to the movies has changed. So that's different. And then the other thing was, of course, just budget. It was more expensive to make that kind of movie. And I'm wondering if it's less expensive now.
Well, no.
Different ways of shooting it. Film versus, or just the high def video that is, interchangeable with film in a lot of instances.
Anything saved in film stock has been made up in other places. I think they're still as expensive as ever. It's just, I hate to say it's an indulgence, because sometimes the movie needs to be through. We just talked about Killers of the Flower Moon, which I felt was, I cut so much out of it because it was one movie instead of a miniseries as it was originally developed to be, that kind of, for me, hurt a little bit. But, I didn't think Oppenheimer was too long. I didn't think Avatar was too long.
I
know, but that's a personal opinion. I'm just saying, I think
No, it's not a personal thing. It's like I both Avatar movies did not need to be as long as they were.
Did you like the Avatar movies, Ron? Because Connor did, so therefore it's longer. Like, do you care?
I wouldn't say that. I enjoyed them, but I didn't love them. You know what I mean? Right. I'm not going out buying an Avatar T-shirt. But it just felt like they dragged where they didn't. And the thing is about it is that like one of the earliest films I ever watched in the first 12 years of my life was Gone with the Wind. Mm-hmm. Right. 221 minutes. Right. Like, talk about a long movie. When I saw it in a movie theater in Atlanta in 1987, they still had an intermission.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, I feel like Flower Moon could. Like, I feel like they should have had an intermission.
They need to bring the intermission back. At least they had it in the old days. They had it. The last time I saw it was The Hateful Eight had an intermission. They need to bring it back.
Yep. Agreed.
Let people pee. There was a guy who sprinted out of my screening. He sprinted out of because of the Flower Moon to go to the bathroom.
Gone with the Wind instilled in me that there is something that is a cinematic epic, that is a story that is so broad and so long and so big that it's justified by being this length. And I don't think you can go back and watch Gone with the Wind and like be like, well, they didn't need the Battle of Atlanta scene or they didn't need this scene or whatever. Like, all the pieces work together, right? And so, like, I definitely think, there are places where, did The Irishman need to be 209 minutes?
I watched it a second time. And I would say in the theater, I think I really felt it other than, like having to go to the bathroom or whatever. But like, I mean, to me, and I don't know if this is still this way, this is probably why people do it, is that like you see a 3-hour movie and you think, okay, well, you've put this much into it. It must be worth that time. And so therefore, from a filmmaker's perspective, maybe they're thinking that same thing. Well, listen, this is great. I need to do this because it's that good. But it often isn't. But like The Irishman, I mean, it's an edge case, I think. I think there's a reason, but I was just pleased to be there.
Right. Did Titanic need to be 195 minutes?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
I had to build up the story. But here's the question. When you see the runtime is 3 hours plus, does it change your desire to see the movie?
Sometimes.
It definitely makes it challenging.
I think
from a logistical standpoint, but just from
Yeah, no, I'm with you. Like, I want to get lost in it. So, like, that's
I think
pretty
it
cool.
depends on what the movie is. So, Napoleon's coming up, right? And
oh, I'm so excited.
Yep.
Right, exactly. Now, like that, you just say Napoleon, I think, yeah, that's got to be 3 hours. You can't do that in two. Like any part of, depending on what they sort of do. So sometimes when something is epic in scope, I think of Godfather 2. Like The Godfather 2 is 3 hours, 22 minutes. Great. I have no problem with it. None.
Napoleon's 2.5 hours.
Yeah. If I look back, Scorsese does it a lot. And I think that the thing with Scorsese is that I'm not always sure I'm going to be rewarded. There's a very good chance I will be rewarded, but there's also a good chance that I'm going to go, oh my God, what is this?
But it's also because he's telling a very complicated story.
How did you feel about Wolf of Wall Street, Josh?
I loved Wolf of Wall Street.
Yeah, he delivered.
And I'm fine with it. And I feel I like Aviator's 250.
Yeah.
Gangs of New York is 247. I'm cool with
You know what I did find in researching 100, not 100, but there are lots of lists of 100 best movies or like 20 best movies that are over 3 hours, something like that. De Niro's in a lot of them. De Niro's in Godfather Part II. De Niro's in The Deer Hunter. De Niro's in Once Upon a Time in America.
See, the Deer Hunter needed to be 3+ hours because you only need to see it the one time.
Right, yeah,
so
exactly.
It's not going to be repeat viewings, so they got to get it all in.
We made the jokes about the end of The Lord of the Rings, right? Where,
But again, like that, they had to tell the story. They had to do the thing. And to me, they put The Scouring of the Shire in at the end. I really like that. But there's other movies where Sergio Leone is a really good example, is that a lot of his movies are very long. So the spaghetti westerns with Clint Eastwood are all like 3 hours a piece, and I don't feel like they need to be. You can get in it. So I remember trying to watch Once a Time in America years ago. I might be different now. It's incredibly long. It's well over 3 hours. Actually, no, apparently it's only 219. That's not right. It's way longer than that.
No, Once Upon a Time in America
there's two cuts of that.
Right. Yeah. So I tried to watch the long cut, and I did not make it at all.
So you guys both have kids, and you get to go to the films as much as you want to, the cinemas.
Yeah.
If you can have a night out with your wife or you're just yourselves, do you take in consideration runtime? Does it become
100%? They can't do it.
I'll speak for Josh.
Wives can't do it either.
Lindsay, 2 hours. That's if it. I mean, if I tell her a movie's 2.5-3 hours, she's going to go, I'm not doing that.
By the way, Once Upon a Time in America, the director's cut's 4 hours.
That's the one.
Four hours, 11 minutes. Joe Pesci, Robert De Niro,
Let's keep in mind that this whole conversation stemmed from a comment my wife made asking if movies really need to be more than 3 hours. So like that sums it up there.
So are we just film assholes? Is that why we don't care about
Movies? But we are. I mean, to a certain degree, we are. I mean, just the same way that we're comics assholes and Josh and I are music assholes and like all this sort of stuff. Like when you're into it, like, yes, great. I'm there for it. Sign me up. I want it. I want to do it. And that's not for everybody. Right. And so like going back to our comedy movie draft and the heyday of the 90-minute film, like, there's a reason why those films do so well.
But also,
right?
Comedies tend to lend themselves to shorter runtimes.
Well, you can only laugh for so long.
Right.
Then Judd Apatow came along to challenge that notion.
And look what happened. Right, I mean, it's true. Like, if you've ever gone to see, like, a comedian and they're really funny, there's usually a point where you don't have any more laughing in you.
Right.
Right.
Now, you know, comedy can kind of work like that. I mean, I think the answer is it's very dependent.
A good film... I don't even notice the clock. Ron and I talked just while you were gone. Neither one of us noticed the clock during this Killers of the Flower Moon.
Right.
A bad 3 hour movie, it's like I'm sliding out of my chair slowly, inch by inch, until I'm on the floor because I want to get out of there because the movie's bad, not because it's long.
And that's at an hour and a half.
Josh and I have very different opinions on Blade Runner 2047. I fucking loved it. Josh fucking hated it.
I still haven't seen it.
I think you can catch the end of it. It's still right, running.
For Josh, it's still playing. But for me, I didn't even notice it for a second how long it was. So it just all depends on how much you have bought into the world and the story.
Well, yeah, great example. JFK, I'm there for it. More than 3 hours, awesome. Dances with Wolves, go fuck yourself. Right? That movie doesn't need to be 3 hours long. Right?
I mean, JFK is a really good example. So, yeah. I think for me, it has a lot to do with how the movie moves. So if we're talking about Blade Runner 2049? 2040,
not going to work anymore.
All right, so whatever.
2049.
There was so much time of just stillness and silence that I get it.
Isn't the case in The Irishman?
I don't know. I don't remember it that way.
The difference is they just really liked The Irishman. Like, I think.
Yeah,
I think
no, that's what I'm getting at is that just like for whatever. Or so if you take The Wolf of Wall Street, like that movie is moving constantly.
That's an old school Scorsese film.
And so like that kind of energy really keeps me going. It keeps me entertained. You know what? Actually, I thought that The Hateful Eight is too long. I don't know that there was enough to sustain it for that long. I think sometimes Tarantino goes a little longer than he needs to. Like Pulp Fiction.
That was just shy of 3 hours, 2:55. Yeah,
Pulp Fiction.
How long was Once Upon a Time in Hollywood?
It's around 3 hours. But that's that's one.
Is it?
Yeah.
That's two and a half.
It's long.
2:40.
That's pretty long.
What's the difference?
Well, but what's Pulp Fiction? Pulp Fiction's like a 1 hour 40.
Oh, yeah, it's tight. It's tight. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, it rewards that.
No, Pulp Fiction's 2.5.
You're shit.
Wow.
2:34.
That's how good that movie is.
Right.
Yeah.
So, you know, like, I guess the point is that you don't know. I think The Godfather is shorter than we think. Jaws is extremely short.
It just comes down to the quality of the film and how much you're connected to it. The Godfather is 2:55.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's funny because we saw it last year in the theater, the re-release.
Lindsay made it through.
Oh, she was rapt. She hadn't really seen it for a long time because I think that she had decided because it was long and old and I liked it that she wouldn't like it. And she was like, that was amazing. I was like, yeah. And again, like we did go in the afternoon. That made a big difference because it was on my birthday. And so, you know, she was able to go in with that. But I mean, the thing is, the fact that I just named all those movies, I go, that was short. And none of them were. But it didn't matter because they keep you going. And I think that's going to be different for everybody. It's different for Connor and I.
Right.
It just depends if you like it or not. That's what it comes down to for me is whether or not you like the movie. If you don't like the movie, it can be an hour and a half. And that's too long.
Well, there's movies I like that don't need to be necessarily long. Like I said, The Hateful Eight, I think, is one of those. It just went on for a really long time. There's parts of it that are self-indulgent. Like Connor and I have talked a lot of times on our other show about how I have a pretty strict definition of what needs to be included. You know, things need to be about the story. Things need to keep stuff moving. You know, there's parts of movies that I really like that sort of do go on too long. But at the same time, you know, we were just talking about those epic movies, you know, Gladiator. We're talking about, you know,
Spartacus,
Napoleon, Spartacus. Like,
what do you feel about The Right Stuff?
I saw it on the list and I was like, I had no idea it was that long.
3:13.
You know what? Tack another hour on that motherfucker. And I'm there. I have no problem with that. I could watch any part of that movie. I could watch Chuck Yeager crash and just walk across the desert for 40 minutes.
I mean, and it goes back. Like, so meanwhile, would you watch Magnolia?
I only watched Magnolia once, and I don't like Paul Thomas Anderson, though.
I know. That's why I asked it. Yeah.
I recently saw it in the theater. That was one where I was sliding out of my seat. I mean, I saw it originally when we were young.
Really?
That's seeing it again is my 40s. I was sliding inch by inch out of my seat trying to escape the theater.
I got one for you that's kind of more closer to our oeuvre. Avengers Endgame. 3 hours, 2 minutes.
I felt it.
Not a good movie.
You felt it.
I felt it. I definitely felt it.
What about Pearl Harbor?
That was a terrible movie.
It's a great movie. There is a rule in both my house and my sister's house that if Pearl Harbor is on TV at any point, it's the TV's on, keep it on, we're watching Pearl Harbor.
Connor, isn't that surprising? Because, again, this
it's
is a guy
who surprising on about 15 levels.
Right, because A, not a war movie guy, but the no. one that he likes is the terrible one.
So do we have a conclusion to come from the question of does any movie need to be 3 hours? I think the answer is sure. Yeah. If it warrants it and if it's good.
Yeah, I mean, when my wife posed the question, I laughed and I'm like, yes, of course. Right, but I think it's worth exploring and it's worth looking at. But I do think that it is justified and it's you know, and like the movies that are shit that are 3 hours, I'm not going to go see. So it's like
I think that there's a wrench to be thrown in here is that in the new sort of economy of watching films, which is not as much in the theater and more at home. If there's a 3 hour movie I want to see, I need to go to the cinema because otherwise I won't make it through it.
Yeah.
Someone in our Discord, this is not attacking them, but someone said, I can't wait for it to come out in streaming so I can pause it 3 times. And it just broke,
I have no interest in doing that. No interest in doing that.
These movies are designed to be seen in one sitting. If you lose something when you stop, and I realize sometimes you have to, things you can't control,
sure.
But like if you're designing in your head, I'm going to watch it in 3 parts. It's just like, it makes my heart crack open because it's just like, that's not the point of what we're doing here.
Well, in the theater, I don't have the choice.
Right.
If I get distracted, then, you know.
I do have to laugh because I did look on one of the stupid clickbait sites about like worst 3 hour long movies, right? One of these sites did the five best and 5 worst movies with the longest run times, right?
I would like to hear.
Ready? So best, Gone with the Wind. Agreed. Worst, 1996, Kenneth Branagh's Hamlet.
I don't think I've ever seen that.
No.
Best, Lawrence of Arabia. Totally agreed there.
Yes.
Worst, 1995, Oliver Stone, Nixon.
I could watch that again.
I saw that one time. I'd watch it again.
Best, The Right Stuff. We talked about that earlier. Worst, Cleopatra, starring Elizabeth Taylor, which is,
never
if you know about history of Hollywood, that is a shit show of a movie. Yeah, that's for sure. So.
It's important.
Best, Godfather Part Two. Worst, The Irishman.
Whoa.
There's your clickbait. There's your clickbait. Just ignore it.
I can tell you where the age range of that writer is.
Sure. But the punctuation, the cherry on top of this, best, Return of the King, wrapping up the Lord of the Rings trilogy. Worst, Pearl Harbor.
Literally no one thinks Pearl Harbor is a good movie.
I enjoyed Pearl Harbor.
Like no one. Ben Affleck certainly doesn't.
Yeah.
Cuba Gooding Jr. might.
I wonder sometimes if the preponderance of 3 hour movies are close to that is because to get people to come back to the theater, they want to give them like something that's media and spectacle. But I wonder if that backfires on people not going because they feel like it's too long.
Right.
And I don't know the answer. I'm just throwing it out there.
It's a good point. I think maybe there's part of it, but I would think that theaters would be savvy enough to know that they would err on the side of keeping things short because nobody has an attention span anymore and too much going on. And they make the same amount of money.
Right.
Well, they make more money, more showings.
Right. But even so, like, you know, like having people in the theater for that much time, like they're not keeping it running. They're not. I don't know. Maybe they sell more popcorn. But
it just kills me when I see people looking forward to watching streaming so they can pause it. It's just like, oh, God.
Yep.
No,
you're
going to
kill Scorsese.
Like.
You're going to kill him. He's going to read that and he's going to die.
Dude, he's going to be 95 and you'd be like, you look like hell. How are you still making movies?
Well, as we talked about in the review, we hope he makes 5 more movies in the next 10 years.
He's just getting to the part where he's starting to understand himself. He's almost there.
I flew close to the sun for this one. For Irishman, I didn't drink or eat anything for like an hour before the movie.
Oh, wow.
And I locked in. And then for this one, I was like, you know what? My body is years and years of going to conventions and not going to the bathroom. I'm not doing it because you're locked in or being on long flights. Fuck it. So I had a soda. I had a candy. And I was fine.
I'll go to the bathroom. I go to the bathroom in the movie.
I will not go to the bathroom.
I try not to unless I absolutely have to.
What was your Flower Moon snack situation looking like?
I had a ginger ale and I had a bunch of crunch and we shared a popcorn.
Wow.
Do you ever go see one of those big movies and think, this food is not appropriate for the subject matter?
Yeah, that's usually like my popcorn movie eating. But
do you want, like we're going to go see Oppenheimer. I do want M&Ms, they're there, but I feel like that doesn't go together.
I shouldn't be popping M&Ms in my mouth as the world blows up. Yeah.
Yep.
Right. Yeah.
Yep.
Well, so my Flower Moon, I didn't do a drink because I didn't want to have to pee. So I just went without a beverage. I got an ice cream sandwich to start.
Oh.
And then about an hour and a half into the movie, I cracked open a box of Raisinets, and that took me through the rest of the film.
Ron, I don't think that you understand that you've been chronically dehydrated your whole life. Like, you have no idea that that's actually what's – you don't even know what it feels like to just to be normal. Hydrated.
Yeah.
All right. So if a movie's good, it can be 3 hours. If it's bad, it should not be.
It should be.
Thank yeah, that's God we were fair, here to come to that conclusion.
That is our thesis.
If you like that thing, you should eat it. But if you don't, let someone else eat it.
So there you go. That was Media Split episode 41, talking about Killers of the Flower Moon and long movies and all the other nonsense that came before. We are always around, Josh and I, talking about the week's new comics on the Pick of the Week show. Ron is talking about Android phones and Android Faithful.
Oh, yeah.
That's every week for both of those shows. We often have many other shows at iFanboy.com, many of them locked by the patrons at patreon.com/iFanboy. Thank you for unlocking this show. And thank you for being a patron, supporting us all throughout this year of 2023. We only have one more of these shows, guys. November's Media Explode.
Ever?
Then December gets taken over by the All Media Year-End Roundup.
Oh, in 2023, right?
Yeah, this year. Okay. Yeah, so we have one more in this year, and then December will be the big three-hour-plus show, the All Media Year-End Roundup. And that's what I'll be looking forward to that in December. And until all those things happen, I'm Connor.
I'm Ron.
Josh Flanagan.
Oh, he taught me to love him and call me his flower. That's blooming to cheer him through life's dreary hour. Oh, I long to see him and regret the dark hour. He's one that's neglected this pale wild flower.